The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
And this is a key point, Mr. President. For those people out there who have not been following it as closely, can you explain to those people why it was critical for the United States to go into Iran? Can you articulate what was behind move that was so important for the U.S. to go into Iran?
Yeah, so easy. The easiest question you've asked me so far, they can't have nuclear weapons.
And the reason that you feel they cannot have a nuclear weapon, because they will use it. And that's what I wanted you to explain to the audience.
Yeah, I think they would use it. And they'd start with Israel, and one weapon would, you know, do damage like nobody's ever seen. Wipe it out, conceivably, big one.
Now,
not wipe it out. They don't need more than one. And then they go after the Middle East, and then they'd eventually come here.
As high-level talks between the United States and Iran have concluded with no deal. It was the first direct talks between the two countries in a decade and the highest level talks between the two since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The talks beginning on Saturday and lasting 21 hours in Islamabad, Pakistan. Vice President J.D. Vance was in Pakistan leading the U.S. delegation, along with Jared Kushner and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, as a fragile ceasefire has been underway between the two sides since Tuesday, after President Trump agreed to give Iran 2 more weeks to open up the Strait of Hormuz or face further destruction. Now the president will implement a naval blockade on the strait.
We have been at it now for 21 hours, and we've had a number of substantive discussions with the Iranians. That's the good news. The bad news is that we have not reached an agreement, and I think that's bad news for Iran much more than it's bad news for the United States of America.
I wouldn't just say that things went wrong. I also think things went right. We made a lot of progress, but we also made very clear, and I think this is part of the progress we made, what the terms where the United States could make some accommodation, what terms we were flexible on, and what things we absolutely needed to see in order for the president of the United States to feel like he was getting a good deal. And so we laid those things out. We had some good conversations. I think it was the first time that you had ever seen the Iranian government, the U.S. government meet at such a high level, maybe in the history of the current leadership of Iran. So that's, I think, a positive. And again, we did make some progress in the negotiation. The big question from here on out is whether the Iranians will have enough flexibility, whether the Iranians will accept the critical things that we need to see in order for things to get done.
Started off weak. They came in like they had the cards, but they don't have the cards. Their army, their whole military is obliterated. The whole place is obliterated. And, you know, as you know, levels of leaders are gone. They're literally gone. But we had a very intensive negotiation, and toward the end it got very friendly, and we got just about every point we needed, except for the fact that they refused to give up their nuclear ambition. And that's the only point, frankly, to me, that was the most important point by far. They want to have nuclear weapons. They're not going to have nuclear weapons. I've been saying that for 30 years. I would never allow that to happen before I was in politics. And that country will not have nuclear weapons. Most countries shouldn't be allowed to have, but that country will not have nuclear weapons. No, we're just bringing the ships up. We got a lot of ships. We're bringing them up. We think that numerous countries are going to be helping us with this also, but we're putting on a complete blockade. We're not going to let Iran make money on selling oil to people that they like and not people that they don't like or whatever it is. It's going to be all or none, and that's the way it is. And it'll be, you saw what we did with Venezuela. It'll be something very similar to that, but at a higher level.
I can tell you that we've been called by the other side. They'd like to make a deal very badly. Very badly.
What was the sticking point over? You said it was over nuclear.
It was over nuclear. Very similar. Yeah, very good. I guess you're listening. It's over the fact that they will never have a nuclear weapon. Iran, you marking it down? Iran will not have a nuclear weapon. And we agreed to a lot of things, but they didn't agree to that. And I think they will agree to it. I'm almost sure of it. In fact, I am sure of it. If they don't agree, there's no deal. There'll never be a deal. Iran will not have a nuclear weapon, and we're going to get the dust back. We'll get it back either. We'll get it back from them, or we'll take it. We've been called this morning by the right people, the appropriate people, and they want to work a deal.
Pretty good rundown of the last 3 days, the Ambassadors for Peace. They are hard at work. That last one there from, I think, earlier today or maybe late yesterday, where now Iran evidently is calling American negotiators to come back to Pakistan or wherever to see if they can hammer out a deal they weren't able to agree upon over the weekend. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. You can get to the live video stream of this program at Trumpet Daily. Well, yeah, at TrumpetDaily.com or at TheTrumpet.com or the Rumble channel or YouTube. I mean, we're just kind of watching this from afar. You wish you could be a fly on the wall and actually hear what they're trying to hammer out for 20-some hours. Because every time you hear President Trump or J.D. Vance speak, I mean, the bottom line is no nukes. And then you hear reports this morning of, well, a 20-year moratorium and Iran saying, well, how about 5 years? So it seems like America is willing to compromise, to meet in the middle somewhere. But I think a larger point to make here is just how excited, and I know we've made this point before with Witkoff and Kushner and so on, but how excited America is when you can sit down and talk. And J.D. Vance, we have a clip later, we'll show you. He made the point that, you know, we want to welcome Iran into the company of nations. I've read my father's writings on the mistake it is to negotiate with terrorists. And again, looking at it from Iran's perspective, again, President Trump can tighten the screws on Iran these next 2 or 3 weeks because of the blockade now on Iran, something he should have done from the beginning. And that's another angle too. I mean, step back and think, what has it been, 45 days, 50 days almost? This ongoing war, and for a couple weeks in there, you had President Trump just lambasting Europe because of Iran's blockade on Hormuz. And then all the stories about how that they were going to charge these exorbitant fees for ships to come in and out. And finally, you know, you wonder how much strategy this is, or if it's just Donald Trump stumbling upon, well, this is the way to do it. Blockade the strait so that Iran can't use it as well. And you choke the life out of Iran, and you hit China indirectly as well because they can't get the cheap oil from Iran. There's some leverage that the U.S. has. And as I say, they could really tighten the screws here. But in the same way that you hear them again and again, no nukes, no nukes, no nukes, they also say, we love the dialogue, we love the dialogue, we love talking. We learned about the Iranian negotiators. We think that we can come to an agreement somehow, some way. You know, that same kind of thinking that we've seen from Witkoff. You know, dialogue can solve everything. Just to bring you down to the latest, you heard it there at the last bit of the cold open. Iran evidently now calling back, saying we want to negotiate some more. This article says negotiating teams from the U.S. and Iran could return to Islamabad this week. Four sources said on Tuesday, days after the highest level talks between the two countries since 1979, ended in the Pakistani capital without a breakthrough. A source involved in the talks said a date was not yet decided, but both countries could return as early as this weekend. Here's another bit from J.D. Vance's interview on Fox News, clip 8.
What the President of the United States has said is, number one, Iran can never have a nuclear weapon. So all of our red lines flow from that fundamental premise, because it is one thing for the Iranians to say,
that they themselves are never going to have a nuclear weapon. They are willing to say that, and that's good. But you have to, of course, verify these things. And the second thing is that, again, to this point about verification, it's one thing for the Iranians to say that they're not going to have a nuclear weapon. It's another thing for us to put in place the mechanism to ensure that's not going to happen. Part of that is, of course, to ensure that they don't have the ability to enrich uranium, which is how they got so close to a nuclear weapon before. So those are really the two things where, frankly, the Iranians, I think, did make some progress. They moved in our direction, which is why I think we would say that we had some good signs, but they didn't move far enough.
They didn't move far enough. So, I mean, going into the next round of negotiations, if the red line really and truly is no nukes, seems like it could be about a 20-minute discussion. But we'll see. We'll see how that this plays out. Leaving all of that aside, I mean, it's a mistake to sit down and talk and talk and talk and talk. Just close the Strait of Hormuz, as the U.S. has done these last couple days. And then tell them, look, this is the red line. Unconditional surrender. Let's go back to that. You've got China reaching out to the U.S. this week as well. They know that the U.S. has some leverage here. All those ships, we have many ships, says President Trump. They're all heading to the Strait of Hormuz. Skip ahead to, just to go, come back to this point about how excited American negotiators are with negotiation and dialogue and talking. This is number 10.
We also made clear, Brett, that we actually would be very happy. The President of the United States has said he would be very happy if Iran was treated like a normal country, if it had a normal economy, if its people were able to prosper and thrive. But in order for Iran to be a normal country economically, it's going to have to be a normal country from the perspective of not pursuing a nuclear weapon, and it's going to have to be a normal country from not pursuing terrorism. And so there really is, I think, a grand deal to be had here. But it's up to the Iranians, I think, to take the next step.
We'd be very happy to treat Iran like a normal country. Has Iran treated America or Israel or Western nations in general like normal countries these past 47 years? To think that that's going to just switch overnight with the snap of a finger? I mean, J.D. Vance, the vice president, he does bring more authority into these high-level negotiations than Witkoff and Kushner, but still, it's dialogue with terrorists. Just coming back to this choke point that is the Strait of Hormuz, as I say, I mean, this is something that America should have done from the beginning. Instead, I mean, like we had on this issue of the trumpet a month or so ago, the world's uniting against America. There's a political story, by the way, which has practically the same headline. Instead, I mean, we've been offending Europeans. We've been lashing out at the way they govern. We've been saying, you're not helping us. I think it would have been much more effective for the U.S. to go in and from day one, cut off the strait, you know, in addition to the bombing campaign, and just say, that's it. You're not going to send your oil out. Forget about the other, you know, Gulf states or Saudi Arabia. You're not going to be able to function. You've got about 2 or 3 weeks to live as a nation. Instead, all of that back and forth with European leaders who aren't even involved. And now they're racing. They're racing to build their own military machine. Not for going against Iran, but to stand up to America. As I keep saying, I mean, if there's one thing that this president and his administration is very good at, it's accelerating the fulfillment of Bible prophecies. There was a story earlier, I guess a few days ago, about this pipeline in Saudi Arabia. I guess it had gotten damaged during the counterstrikes from Iran. But anyway, it runs from where that Hormuz Strait is, across Saudi Arabia to the other side, which allows for, you know, the oil to bypass that danger zone and to just go under land instead. It says Saudi Arabia restored full pumping capacity to its east-west pipeline, the kingdom's primary crude oil export outlet, the Saudi Energy Ministry said on social media. The pipeline, which lost around 700,000 barrels a day pumping capacity, after it was hit by an Iranian attack last week, is again moving about 7 million barrels of crude a day. 7 million barrels. I think it's through the Strait of Hormuz, it's something like 20 million barrels. So, you know, given the power and the might of the United States of America, you know, to build pipelines or whatever, I mean, I know you can't do that in a week, but still, you move 7 million barrels through the pipeline, you blockade the strait yourself, and you strangle Iran. While Saudi Arabia, I mean, conceivably, America helped some of the Gulf states to get around these Iranian terrorist tactics. You talk about violating international law, but Pope Leo's not going to bring any of this up. What Iran does to the rest of the world, to Europe. There's an article, I'll get to it later, from PJ Media, wondering about how much Pope Leo has brought peace to this earth. It's easy for him to talk about how President Trump hasn't done it. And really, by the world standards, you know, President Trump's out there at least talking about peace more than, you know, any American president I can remember. And you know what we think regarding those peace discussions or negotiations, given what the Bible says about the ambassadors for world peace. They're going to weep bitterly in the end. Man doesn't know the way to peace, as the prophet Isaiah said. But, I mean, the blockade on Iran, that represents a PowerPoint in U.S. strategy. Whether President Trump and his people stumbled upon it, or whether they've been thinking about this for some time. I mean, Iran's on the clock. That's why they're calling. I think they probably did call the Trump administration. We get the back and forth as well on, well, they wanted the negotiation, and then that side says, no, they wanted the negotiation. I think Iran probably did call. They can't have their, I mean, I don't know what the revenue supply is with respect to their oil shipments, but they just can't have everything back up, you know, in all their refineries or oil fields or whatever it is. They're taking a big enough a hit just with the bombing these past 6-7 weeks. So much leverage. And yet, as we know from the prophecies, I mean, America, it's spending strength in vain. We know this. And of course, we've lost the pride in our power. We go in and for a week or two, then we start harping on, you know, Europe's inability to contribute or to support it. And European leaders are seething. The anti-American hatred, that level is rising by the day. So many prophecies coming into alignment. There's been some articles saying that Iran could survive maybe 2-3 weeks. If that American blockade continued, we'll see how it plays out. But just the siege. The siege upon the siege. You had the Iranian siege on Hormuz, and now you've got the American siege, the siege of all sieges. It makes me think of that section in the Overcomer booklet, just to draw a spiritual lesson from this. My father says, Napoleon sought to destroy his enemy's will to resist. That is what we must try to do with our old man. Our problems always try to come back. God instructs us to destroy that old man so completely that he doesn't have the will to come back. You have to destroy the will of that enemy in the spiritual sense, the old man, that old man that needs to be crucified, Galatians 2:20, or destroyed, Romans 6. America has the power to destroy the will of Iran. But as I say, within those clips that you're hearing, you also hear how much America loves to talk about peace, how much America loves to welcome back these enemies into the company of nations. It's not going to end well. And for Iran's part, they're going to do everything they can to say one thing and do another. I mean, that's probably the purpose of stretching these negotiations out for as long as they can. To figure out some way to have a clandestine effort to continue on with their nuke program while on the surface complying with what, you know, U.S. negotiators want. Israel's a part of this struggle as well. And there's a story in the New York Times this morning. Again, when you just talk about strength being spent in vain, Israelis don't feel much like victors in the war with Iran. Again, this is it's the New York Times, so you have to take it with a grain of salt, but the weakness of Israelite nations, America, Britain, little Judah. The roads are jammed again, businesses are reopening, and children have returned to school in all but the far north of Israel. That's because of the ongoing war in Lebanon. Residents have emerged from their bomb shelters, safe rooms. But the 40-day war with Iran and Israel's continuing war with Hezbollah in Lebanon have left many despairing over how little they believe the fighting accomplished compared with the objectives laid out by their leaders. They're tired of fighting, as Olmert said a couple decades ago. They're tired. The New York Times says regime change in Iran. Senior government and military figures have been killed, but the regime is intact. You know, remember this. When you see the negotiators coming out of the negotiating room next time, next weekend maybe, weekend after that, just remember, no regime change. The next one, the destruction of Iran's nuclear program, it was set back but not destroyed. Now President Trump is saying it's going to stop and they're going to get the dust. They're going to get the remnants left of the program. If Iran survives this war and all the negotiations with a nuclear program that is still operational and a regime that's the same, some would say worse, I think that's a pretty big victory for the King of the South. It says here, the elimination of Iran's ability to threaten Israel with ballistic missiles, reduced perhaps, but still a threat. And so, at least according to the New York Times, you've got quite a few Israelis that are, you know, their take on the war is pretty negative. Benjamin Netanyahu's been talking about this for decades, and he's finally getting his opportunity together with the United States. And you see how difficult it is for any Israelite leader to get the support, the full support of the nation, because we're so deeply divided. And you saw this even following October 7 and the approach Israel took to getting back the hostages, even the remains of dead hostages. Anything and everything to make peace. We just need a ceasefire. We will sit down and talk and talk and talk. If you'll just stop killing us, we'll stop shooting. If you tell us, you'll stop killing us. It plays out time and time again, doesn't it? A vicious cycle. 9/11 didn't, I mean, that didn't teach us. October 7 didn't. The faith. I mean, the faith, just to think about faith in God, how it just doesn't exist. But look at how much faith human beings put in other human beings, even ones that look them in the eye and say, I'm going to murder you. You're the little Satan. You're the great Satan. We want to destroy you. President Trump alternately taunts, threatens, and tries to negotiate with the leadership in Tehran. Israel has been left on the sidelines, or as President Trump does this. You know, and again, New York Times hates Trump, but that's a pretty good synopsis of what we're witnessing. He alternately taunts, threatens, and then tries to negotiate. And you got J.D. Vance saying, we would be so happy to just welcome Iran back into the company of nations, to open up the strait. You know, it's all or nothing. That's the U.S. position right now. If you're going to cut off the oil from the Gulf states, from Saudi Arabia, we're cutting off your oil. So right now, it's completely shut down. Then when it's wide open, you know, Iran, China, they're back in business. And then what happens 6 months from now or a couple of years from now? It says here, it appears forced to accept whatever Washington decides, Israel, that is. Israel was not represented at the day-long U.S.-Iran talks in Pakistan over the weekend. Well, how about that? You know, these negotiations, the endless talk, revealing this break in the brotherhood, the band of the brotherhood. Here it's an American-Israel effort. And Israel, just like so much of the dialogue with Hamas, Israel's not even part of the discussion. They're not even in on the negotiations. Barely a third of Israelis now believe that when Israel and the United States disagree, Israel can act on its own judgment. A separate poll, also released Sunday, found that three times as many Israelis saw the war as a failure than a victory. Some 70% said that the two-week ceasefire reflected an American concession to Iran, more than vice versa, and two-thirds said they opposed the truce. So, I mean, it's all over the map, isn't it? Four out of five Israelis believe the U.S.-Iran agreement is unlikely or impossible, and that if one were reached, it would be bad for Israel's security. They're right. They're right. Why don't Israelite nations get the total victory that Israelite leaders often promise? Look at how easy it is. Speaking of dialogue and talk, look at how easy it is to throw around terms like obliteration, unconditional surrender. But what's actually happening? This Times piece says, it's the prospect of wars with no end in sight that's weighing heavily on Israelis. You know, after I got into the Olivet prophecy yesterday, one of the news gatherers emailed me and just said, it's like everything is converging on Matthew 24 and Luke 21 and Mark 13. I mean, if you step back and just look at what has to happen before Christ returns, what is prophesied to happen before Christ returns, just remember the Olivet prophecy. What is the ultimate end of negotiating with the mullahs? Great tribulation. You know, what about cutting off the straits? What about, you know, a siege on a really important passageway? What's that leading to ultimately? Great tribulation. I mean, that's a general answer, I understand. There's a lot of specifics that are going to play out as we go forward. But we know where this is headed. We know where Europe is headed. We know where the King of the South is headed. And sadly, we know where Ephraim, Manasseh, and Judah are headed as well. There's some twists and turns along the way. We can't know all the details. But, you know, another angle to this story to keep an eye on is, as we've said so many times, Herbert Armstrong said it decades and decades before he died, that economic crisis will trigger war, world war, trade wars, an economic crisis, a global downturn, as the Wall Street Journal put it. A prolonged Middle East conflict could slash global growth rates seen only in the deepest recent recessions, according to the IMF. This analyst warned that if the disruptions persist beyond this year, even after the U.S. and Iran reach a tenuous ceasefire agreement, world economic growth could fall to about 2% in 2026. A sluggish rate seen only during the deepest downturns. Further on, it says the multilateral leaders' forecasts often serve as a benchmark for private and official forecasters around the world. So whether it affects Iran in such a way or China or the United States, be looking for a global downturn. An economic downturn, as Herbert Armstrong said, I think it was one of those sermons he gave in the 1980s. He was looking at why God appeared to be holding things back. And as he was analyzing world events, as he was watching and praying always, He said, I think it's going to be an economic crisis that triggers that final formation of the Holy Roman Empire. And that leads to America's downturn as well. I mean, we're already $39 trillion in debt with no end in sight. I mean, we operate as if we have unlimited credit, as if the world loves America, as if the world loves buying American dollars, as if we can print off American dollars, no problem. It's pretty amazing. When we come back, we'll follow up with more on Pope Leo, which we got into yesterday, this feud going on. J.D. Vance recently tried to downplay it. J.D. Vance, a Catholic, by the way. Yesterday I got into it. I don't need to repeat myself, but, you know, it was Hannity who said, has Pope Leo ever read the Bible? And you know, I think I should have verified this. I believe Sean Hannity's a Catholic. So here's J.D. Vance now saying, you know, the Pope should stay in his lane and, you know, not get into politics. But you would think they would step back and say, well, hang on a second. I'm a Catholic. And he's the, speaking of supreme leaders, I mean, he's the supreme leader of our church. And look at the way he's operating. And yet, I guess none of them would ever question their faith or the denomination they're in. It's like I said yesterday. I mean, how can these denominations surrounding Trump during the prayer call be righteous and holy and pro-Trump? That's the reason, of course, they're seen as righteous from the MAGA people. And then on the other hand, you've got, you know, the biggest Christian denomination in the world, the Catholic Church. And you heard yesterday what President Trump said about them, or at least about Leo and his leadership. We'll follow up on that when we come back. We'll take a quick break. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We'll be right back.
One third of your Bible is prophecy, and 90% of it is for our time today. This is why, when you study Bible prophecy, you often read statements like, in that day, in the last days, and at the time of the end. Biblical prophecy is what makes the Bible so relevant to today, so essential to understanding our modern world. Most people, even in the world of religion, assume that nations like Britain, America, Germany, Russia, and China are not mentioned in Bible prophecy. But if prophecy is mainly for our time today, how could the Bible ignore some of the most powerful and prominent nations of today? The key to understanding prophecy is knowing the biblical identities of modern nations. Learn about these identities in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. In this book, you will learn about the astonishing identity of the American and British people in biblical prophecies. Request your free copy today. The United States and Britain in Prophecy.
You know, when it comes to the disagreements with the Vatican, look, we're going to have disagreements, Brett, from time to time. I think it's a good thing, actually, that the Pope is advocating for the things that he cares about. But we're always going to have disagreements on matters of public policy, or I should say, sometimes we're going to have disagreements on matters of public policy. The Pope has been critical of our immigration policy, but ultimately the immigration policy of the United States is set by Donald Trump. The Pope is going to have disagreements on other issues. We can respect the Pope. We certainly have a good relationship with the Vatican, but we're also going to disagree on substantive questions from time to time. I think that's a totally reasonable thing and isn't particularly newsworthy. But I certainly think that in some cases, it would be best for the Vatican to stick to matters of morality, to stick to matters of what's going on in the Catholic Church, and let the President of the United States stick to dictating American public policy. But when they're in conflict, they're in conflict. I don't worry about it too much, Brett. I think it's a natural thing. I'm sure it'll happen in the future, and it's not that big of a deal that it happened in the past.
We're going to disagree. That's normal. It's actually healthy. Now, practicing Catholics believe that the Pope is the vicar of Christ. He's in place of Jesus Christ. And then, like I said yesterday, you have all the talking heads, or at least the left-wingers that are probably about as anti-religious as you could get, calling the Pope Holy Father. He's the Holy Father. And J.D. Vance, for his part, he's Catholic. Hannity, by the way, grew up Catholic. I think he left Catholicism in 2019. So I was off on that right before the break. But I was close. So many Catholics that, I mean, they talk just like J.D. Vance did right there. But why not step back and look at the larger, bigger picture here? If you don't agree with the vicar of Christ, I mean, he is in place of Christ. It says something about your own religion. Politics reigns supreme. I mean, if I played the clip yesterday from President Trump himself. Doesn't like the Pope because the Pope's criticized him. I mean, everybody's loyalty is being tested. A true Christian is loyal to Jesus Christ, 100%. A true Christian puts his faith, his trust in God, 100%. What does God say? We're going to come back to the Olivet prophecy. We need to. I mean, this is, when the disciples came to Jesus Christ in Matthew 24, asking for signs, show us the signs of what's going to happen before the end of this age, the end of the world. And Jesus gave them a lot so that they would be not caught unawares. But, you know, the other thing, I don't know if I made this point yesterday, but my father has said that Christ knew that so many of those disciples were going to be martyred for proclaiming the truth. That was 2,000 years ago. And yet we just somehow think that, you know, the world is going to receive true disciples of Christ. No problem. Open arms. The world didn't receive Christ or his disciples 2,000 years ago. And you can look into the true history of the true church and see that that's the way it's been for two millennia. It's because of instruction like you find in the Olivet Prophecy. The world doesn't like it. They're hard sayings. It tells you the reality of where all of this negotiation, where all of this, you know, strategizing, where all of this military buildup, building war machines, it tells you right where it's headed. Everything intersects with the Olivet Prophecy. That's the truth. It's prophecy for the end time. I mean, basically the disciples said, tell us what's going to happen in the last days, right before you return to this earth. And so there it is. It's described in Matthew 24, Luke 21, Mark 13. But do you think any negotiator is going to go into these high-level negotiations, you know, with that sort of as their blueprint? Well, hang on a second. Let's see what Jesus Christ said about the last days. And you know it's about the last days because he's talking in that same prophecy about his return. Everyone on earth is going to see it. And the nations, like I covered yesterday, they're going to be angry. They're going to mourn the appearance of Jesus Christ. So you can see why they have persecuted the disciples or the students of Christ. Coming back to Pope Leo and this feud, PJ Media talks about the back and forth, the statements, blessed are the peacemakers, and we played this for you yesterday. Pope Leo said, I have no fear of the Trump administration. He's not afraid of Trump. And this guy says, let's start with this quote, blessed are the peacemakers, which he no doubt meant as a dig at Trump for starting the Iran war, starting, in quotes, because Iran actually started it. But we'll leave that aside. Trump didn't start this war any more than Poland started the Second World War. Furthermore, Trump is responsible for forging more permanent peace deals. You know, you really should put permanent in quotes, but that's just me. More permanent peace deals and ending wars than any other than anything either the papacy, Europe, or the UN has done of late. I mean, he brings up a good point. Now, you know, you've heard our critique of these, you know, we've ended 8-9 wars. We're constantly sending the ambassadors for peace out to make peace. And we know how that's going to end because of Bible prophecy. But all of that said, he brings up a good point. I mean, what has the papacy done to bring peace? What about Europe? What about the UN? What has the United Nations done to bring peace to this world? He lists off some of President Trump's accomplishments. The ceasefire between India and Pakistan, that was in May of last year. The peace agreement between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, that was 2025. And again, because of the Olivet prophecy, we know that these peace deals are not going to hold permanently. But still, President Trump's talking about peace nonstop. His negotiators, same thing. And as I said on yesterday's show, I mean, Pope Leo's comments really is, it's nothing more than just talk about peace, about peacemaking. And by the standards set in this world, I mean, you would have to look at what Trump and his team have done and say, well, you know, at least he's out there doing something, trying to, you know, initiate peace talks and build on dialogue and come to an agreement and have a ceasefire. There's a lot of derangement in this world. That's the point. Whether it's coming from, you know, MSNBC or the Vatican or European leaders or even the Jeroboam administration. The whole world is deceived. He lists off more agreements that Trump has reached or brokered with other nations. And then he comes around to Pope Leo and the long list of peace agreements that he's initiated and brokered. And of course, there's a blank list. There's nothing. There's nothing there. Scathing rebuke for the Pope. I wonder if this author is a Catholic. We'll have to look into that at the break. So yes, Pope Leo, blessed are the peacemakers. If you have enough humility to conclude that you're not one of them. Wow, that's pretty strong from PJ Media. That's a conservative voice. Here again, we're seeing just how united and how expansive this so-called religious resurgence really and truly is. In fact, there's not a lot of substance, is there? There's a lot of division. There's a lot of disagreement, as you heard from J.D. Vance. And yet we delude ourselves. We delude our thinking with the reasoning that, well, you know, disagreement's good. Division is good. Well, what about the division between the mullahs and America? Well, maybe not. That's not so good. Or Hamas and Israel. That's a little bit extreme. Or the radical left. And ordinary Americans, after J6, for example. There's some talk about maybe some indictments finally coming down. Bigger names. The United States was attacked from within. And no one to this point was held to account. It's such a dark, dark, evil world. There's just lawlessness on display every day. I mean, we'll get into it tomorrow if we have time. This Swalwell thing. He was running for governor in California. I guess two Republicans were caught in a runoff. And so it looked like, incredibly, that a Republican might win if Swalwell didn't step aside. And so the Democrat Party urged him to do it. He wouldn't do it. And then next thing you know, guess who attacks him? Well, the San Francisco Chronicle and then CNN. These people have known for years and years and years about some of these perverted leaders in their own party. And they expose themselves when they finally pull the rug out from under them because, well, you're not complying politically. So we're going to destroy you. I mean, from the looks of it, we've talked before on this program, sleeping with the enemy, a Chinese spy of all things. That didn't shock anybody. That didn't shock CNN. That didn't shock the San Francisco Chronicle. But now, if the Democrat Party loses, if they lose the governor's race in California, now that's something we've got to act on. It's all politically driven, and it's not just like it's coming from one side, as I said before the break. It all boils down to politics. And you see in the Bible, Revelation 13 and 17, you see this perverse, promiscuous, fornicating, adulterous union between church and state, between religion and politics, and the wave of destruction that it's going to level on the whole of this world. That's what Jesus was talking about in the Olivet Prophecy. Great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of time, since the beginning of human civilization. The world's never seen anything like it. The filth and squalor on this earth. I forget the festival where Trudeau was with his new Hollywood celebrity girlfriend. But here he's, I mean, he basically led Canada like a gangster. And now he's off partying with the Hollywood starlet. That's the reward you get for evil leadership. Well, you can just continue on in evil and never be held to account. How far into this Russia collusion hoax are we? Everything was established on a lie, and yet you see people like Adam Schiff, they get promoted. Swalwell very nearly did. And then Democrats got worried. Hey, we might lose this. Well, here's an idea. Let's destroy one of our own. What a world. You can see why. What's uppermost in God's mind is the work of his church and the church itself and its growth. Because the church, God's church, his little flock, by the way, headed up by righteous leadership, his church is the kingdom of God in embryo. A new nation is about to be born. And the nations of this world, as I read yesterday, Revelation 11, verse 15, read it. The nations of this world are about to become the nations underneath God's kingdom, underneath the rule of Jesus Christ, King of Kings. This article on Leo says, Pope Leo and Pope Francis before him routinely make universal calls for peace, as if both sides to a conflict are equally guilty. That's exactly right. Let's see, World War II, you got Germany and Poland on the one hand, or both hands. I guess they're both guilty. Let's see, Hamas, Israel, October 7, yeah, but disproportionate. They're both guilty. And now here we come to America and Iran. America, Israel against Iran. Iran and its 47-year campaign to murder Jews and Americans. And you've got this, perhaps the most prominent religious head on earth, acting as if, you know, there's an equivalence there. They're both guilty. In fact, and you see this coming out in statements from Europe as well, America's more guilty, of course. Pile it on America. Pile on top of the Jews. It's so easy, and it's so predictable, isn't it? Where is it leading? Everything's converging on the Olivet Prophecy, what Christ described in the greatest sermon on prophecy in history. And more preachers should be pointing you to it. As I said yesterday, I mean, you just go right down. And I'll do it. I don't have time on today's show, but I'll do it. Verse by verse. Wait a second. Let me write this down. We've got to watch world events and then pray always that we might be worthy to escape. What do we need to escape? Well, Great Tribulation. Oh, that, well, yeah, that makes sense. Perfect sense. We've got to be ready. I mean, if you knew there was a thief coming in the middle of the night, what would you do? How alert would you be? How prepared would you be for the attack? If you knew in advance. That's what Christ gave us in the Olivet Prophecy. Advance notice of the explosions of violence, the tribulation, the suffering, the heavenly signs, the day of the Lord, all of those things. And most in this world have very little, if any, understanding of any of it. As if both sides to a conflict are equally guilty. As if those who launched the Warsaw Uprising against the Nazis are equally to blame for the Second World War. As if the 12-year-old Dundee girl who used an axe to defend her, to defend herself and her sister from a would-be rapist needs to do her part to bring down the temperature. Remember that story? A couple years back, I think it was. She wields an axe and there were plenty of commentators ready to pile on top of her. You can't just wield an axe in Britain. We don't do that. Well, what do you do if a rapist comes out? What about the rapist? Is he a problem? Both sides in the conflict, they're equally guilty. You know, the rapist and the little girl who pulled out an axe to try to defend her sister. That's the world we're living in. Pope Leo, your criticism is misplaced, this author says. Take a step back, look at the world around you, and ask yourself, what are your goals? He says later, at least Trump's doing something to try to end suffering, to try to dial down the danger. What are religious leaders doing? What is religion doing, period? Over and again. And Herbert Armstrong said this in Mystery of the Ages. When you see what's wrong with religion, then you'll understand why there's so much wrong with this world. Religion, time and time again, has not been part of the solution. It's been part of the problem. And the reason is because people just, they pick one verse here or there, and then they ignore the entire Olivet Prophecy. Christ in the Olivet Prophecy is basically telling us, this is what you're doing. This is where it's leading, cause and effect. You've caused this. Human nature's caused this. Human beings are the cause of this. And of course, behind all of that is the prince of the power of the air, the god of this world, Satan the devil, who's deceived the whole world. Everything is intersecting directly with the Olivet Prophecy. Everything is pointing to these signs that Jesus Christ spoke about in Matthew 24. My father has this article. I referred the students to it, the freshmen, earlier this week. Nuclear Armageddon is at the door. I mean, that's a sobering title for sure. I don't have time to read much of it. But the start here says, Matthew 24 is the most important prophecy that Jesus Christ proclaimed at his first coming. That's pretty significant. The most important prophecy Jesus proclaimed? In this chapter, Christ prophesied about a volcanic eruption of crises on earth such as has never been experienced, and about the birth of a new age that will come from it. Jesus Christ has prevailed and has revealed this, and we're now seeing these prophecies being fulfilled. And then he says this, I'll leave you with this. Everything revolves around this prophecy. It reveals more to you about what is happening now than any other chapter in the Bible. Pivotal prophecy. Everything revolves around it, which is why we need to dig into it in future programs. As for this program, we're out of time. The fastest moving hour in broadcasting. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.